The work called Tanya, the Book of the Beinoni, is addressed to a category of Jew that the Talmud describes as the Beinoni, the in-between, the person who is not quite a tzaddik, not quite a righteous person, not a saint, and also not a sinner, not a sinful person. The Tanya begins with a quote from the Talmud, a quote with the Gemara, where the Gemara tells us that before the soul comes into the body, it is given instruction and advice. The instruction is, be a tzaddik, be righteous, and do not be a rasha, do not be sinful. That's the instruction. The advice is that even when everyone around you tells you that you have attained the level of righteousness, that you are a tzaddik, don't believe them and continue to consider yourself sinful. The Rebbe has two questions. One, concerning the instruction. Why the double expression? Be a tzaddik, don't be a rasha. Sounds redundant. If you're a tzaddik, you're not a rasha. If you're righteous, you're not sinful. If you're sinful, you're not righteous. So it would have been enough to simply say one or the other. Either instruct the soul to be righteous, or instruct the soul not to be sinful. But why the duplication? Question number two. Concerning the advice, even if the whole world tells you that you're righteous, you should consider yourself sinful, how does considering yourself sinful help you serve God properly? We know that we're supposed to serve God with joy. Where is the joy if a person really thinks of himself as a sinful person? So the practical problem, the practical question of, is it better to serve God with joy, or is it more important to consider yourself sinful? To answer this question, these questions, the Rebbe introduces us to a deeper understanding and a better appreciation of what these three categories are which the Gemara speaks of. The tzaddik, completely righteous, the sinful, person who sins, and the beinoni, who is neither one nor the other. The problematic one is the beinoni, because what do you mean, neither sinful nor righteous? If he doesn't sin, then he is righteous. If he does sin, then he is sinful. How can you be in between? How can you be morally ambivalent and not be a sinner or sinful? So what really is a beinoni? If the beinoni, if the person had sinned and has not repented the sin, then he is a sinner. If he repents the sin, then he's righteous. His sin is erased, and he's a tzaddik. When is he a beinoni? And even a slight sin makes you sinful. In fact, even if you could have prevented someone else from sinning and didn't make the effort or didn't bother to try, you are then guilty of the other person's sin, and that, the Gemara tells us, is also a sinful person. So what's a beinoni? From a little incident described in the Gemara, the Alter Rebbe proves that a beinoni couldn't possibly be half good and half bad, because Rabbah, one of the great sages and one of the great saints, was teaching his students about these three categories of tzaddik, beinoni, and rasha. And then he said, I am a good example of a beinoni. Now, we know that Rabbah never sinned. Rabbah never even interrupted his study of Torah, to the point where on the day that he was to die, the angel of death couldn't approach him because he didn't stop studying Torah. And yet he calls himself a beinoni. Now, even in the greatest of humility, Rabbah could not have distorted the facts and distorted his own perception of himself to such a degree that he was half sinful. He was as sinful as he was virtuous, when in fact he wasn't sinful at all. So humility would mean that where there are two equally acceptable possibilities, equally feasible, the humble person will take the less complimentary possibility. The arrogant person will assume the more complimentary. But to distort the facts, to actually lie about yourself, is not humility, it's self-deception. So when Zabba says, I am a Beinoni, it proves conclusively that a Beinoni must be someone who behaves like a tzaddik, so that a person who is a tzaddik can actually believe himself to be a Beinoni, because outwardly they look alike, which means that the tzaddik does not sin, the Beinoni does not sin. The tzaddik never fails to do a mitzvah, the Beinoni never fails to do a mitzvah. So in behavior, they're indistinguishable. They behave exactly alike. And as the Rebbe will tell us later on, not only in actual behavior and deeds, but also the other parts of behavior, which are thought and speech. The Beinoni not only is virtuous in his deeds, he's also virtuous in his speech. He will never say what isn't permissible. And he is virtuous in his thoughts. He will never entertain a thought that isn't permissible. And so by looking at his thoughts, his speech, and his actions, Zabba could not tell whether he was a tzaddik or a Beinoni. Now by telling us all of this, the Rebbe is forcing us beyond the surface, past the surface. By telling us that a tzaddik and a Beinoni are indistinguishable in their behavior, and yet a tzaddik is a completely different category of human being from the Beinoni, we are forced to deal with a soul difference, an internal difference, a difference in their neshama. And so the Rebbe says, a tzaddik is someone who has no evil inclination. He is not tempted to sin, it's just not in him. He finds no pleasure in that which is sinful. He finds no pleasure in anything that God prohibits. And so he's not attracted to it, he's not tempted by it, there's no struggle there. The Beinoni, on the other hand, does have an evil inclination. He will sense the pleasure or the desire for that which is forbidden, but has no intention of ever committing the sin, neither in thought, nor in speech, nor in action. And to appreciate this, the Rebbe says, we first have to introduce the types of souls that we embody. The Ari, the Kabbalist from Tzfas, of 400 years ago, if the authority on Kabbalah, tells us that every person, whether good or bad, every person has two souls. The first is a human soul, which influences the body and is active in the body right from the moment of birth. This soul is referred to in the Torah, in Scripture, as the soul of the flesh. The soul of the flesh means the human soul, or the anima soul, the animal soul, the soul that animates the body, that gives life to the body. This soul is present in the blood, and that's why we're not allowed to drink blood of an animal. It's present in the blood, and it produces all the negative qualities that a human being has. Because of its elements, the fire, air, water, and earth of the soul, the characteristics that this soul produces are, for example, fire of the soul produces anger and arrogance because it rises like fire. The water of the soul produces lust or passion, because water creates desire and pleasure. In folk wisdom, a person who does not feel pleasure, who does not take pleasure in life, is called a dry person, because pleasure is the is in the water of life. Then there are the characteristics produced by the air of the soul, and that is the scoffing, the boasting, the idle talk, the escapist kind of activity, where a person takes pleasure in just being nothing and doing nothing and staying away from anything meaningful. That's produced by the air, as the expression airhead. And then there's the element of earth that produces depression and laziness, because earth is the heavy element. So the heaviness produces characteristics that are heavy: laziness and sadness and depression. This natural soul in some people also produces good qualities, positive qualities, such as compassion and generosity. Compassion and generosity are good qualities because in both instances, the person is experiencing the reality and the importance of another creature over and above the reality and importance of himself. Generosity doesn't mean, I give you money because I'm a nice guy. Generosity means, if you need, then how can I not give you? Because your need is just as real as mine, if not more real. And since I don't need the money and you do, then the money rightfully belongs to you, because you need and I don't. Or, even if I need the money as much as you do, the classical example of two people in a desert and there's one sandwich belonging to one of them, who gets to eat the sandwich? True generosity dictates that the other person's hunger is more important than mine, and so I would give the other person the sandwich. Not out of an act of nobility, but simply out of a sense of justice, he really needs it more than I do. The ability to put another person's need above your own, that is true goodness. The ability to feel the other person's need more deeply than your own, that's true goodness. Now, that's not godliness, but it is good. So even the natural soul, the human soul, or the animal soul, in probably most people, produces these positive qualities of generosity and compassion. There's also an animal soul, a natural soul, in which there is no positive qualities at all. Natively, instinctively, they have no sense of goodness. Only through conviction, only by learning, only by choosing the virtuous, do they acquire virtue in their lives. But no goodness comes naturally. And so we find that all the experts in psychology, all the authorities on human nature, all agree that everything a human being does is motivated by self-interest, is motivated by self-preservation, and even the kindness and the generosity and the compassion that people show is really coming from a self-motivated, a self-actualizing, becoming all that you can be instinct, which is a branch or a detail within our survival instinct. So that even the desire to be noble, even the desire to find meaning and significance in life, is motivated not by the recognition of something greater than myself, but by recognizing that that will make me great. And so the Talmud says that all the kindness that people do is all motivated by the desire for self-aggrandizement. And what that means is not necessarily the cheapest or lowest form of boasting, of showing off that I'm good, but rather the true self-aggrandizement, meaning looking to become more human, looking to elevate ourselves to a higher level. But wanting to improve ourselves through morality and through goodness is really not true goodness, because it's motivated by a desire to make myself better, higher, all I can be. Whereas real goodness, as we said before, is the ability or the instinct where we put the other person above ourselves, and it's the other person's need that makes us do the act of generosity or compassion, and not the desire to improve ourselves or to develop our spiritual side. So we have two kinds of people. The person who has this native instinctive goodness, the ability to put others before themselves, and then there are those who cannot put others above themselves and will be kind to others because that's right and good for themselves. The qualities, the characteristics that the animal soul produces, or the anger and arrogance, desire and passion, lightheadedness, idle talk, boasting, and laziness and sadness or melancholy, all have one thing in common. And that is that the animal soul takes itself very seriously. There's a certain arrogance, a certain selfishness behind everything that the animal soul does. Except for those good traits where we actually put someone else above ourselves. Other than that, all the negative traits are negative not only because they might be evil or destructive or unfriendly, but primarily because they are so selfish. The animal soul takes itself very seriously. And the reason for it is that the animal soul is mortal. It's the soul of the flesh, and it is mortal, as is the flesh. And that mortality, that thought in the back of its mind that I may not exist at some time, makes it desperate for survival. And in its desperation to survive, all of its characteristics, all of its impulses become self-centered, selfish, and self-preserving, self-preservation. Primarily, it seeks pleasure in various different ways. Arrogance is pleasurable to an arrogant person. So the person is arrogant because it holds an appeal. It draws the person. It offers a pleasure, the pleasure of arrogance. The same is true with anger. We may think that when we get angry, we are uncomfortable and we would rather not be angry. But we get angry only because there is some pleasure in it. Whether it's the pleasure of letting off steam, it's an outlet for pent-up feelings, whatever the reason is, but it is a pleasure. Even laziness is a pleasure. Even sadness is a pleasure. Sadness gives you the comfort, the pleasure, of not having to have emotions. So sadness means no feeling, non-feeling, tuned out to emotions. And that itself is the pleasure in a person who is too exhausted or too tired or too lazy to have an emotion. Now, what about the air qualities? It's interesting that the fire quality produces arrogance. The air quality produces boasting. Now, what is the difference between arrogance and boasting? Arrogance is a person who really has a superiority complex, truly is convinced that he is better, greater, and superior to everyone else, or to certain people. But his arrogance is a conviction. He really believes himself to be superior. And in fact, he may even have superior qualities. He may excel. He may be better than everybody else. But the focus and the pleasure that he gets from that superiority is what makes him arrogant. Boasting, on the other hand, is not something a superior person experiences. The boastful person is not convinced that he is superior, would not even enjoy being superior. He doesn't want to be the best of the best. Boasting means to take credit for something I know I don't deserve. I boast of things that I know are not true. I make claims without ever really believing them. And the pleasure of it is the fact that there is no truth to it. It's very much like idle gossip or idle talk. What is the point? What's the pleasure of idle talk? The pleasure of idle talk is the very fact that it is devoid of any meaning and substance. It's like when you want to go to a movie that has absolutely no message. You don't want a meaningful movie. You don't want a movie with a moral. You want to go to a movie that has nothing, no content, pure escapist stuff. And that itself is its own pleasure. That's the pleasure of air. Air doesn't necessarily rise like fire. It doesn't drop like water. And it doesn't resist movement like earth. It's really without opinion. It can go any way or go no way, and it doesn't matter. That's the pleasure that the air quality in the soul produces in people who are cynical, don't want to take an opinion, doubt everything, can't be sure, jest about everything, or just make idle talk without really meaning what they say, and making idle claims without really believing them at all, which is the boasting. That's chapter one. In chapter two, the Rebbe introduces us to the second kind of soul. The second kind of soul is divine. Divine meaning that it is not a created soul, it's not the soul of the flesh, and is therefore not mortal. The godly soul, the divine soul, is a piece of God, eternal as is God, and therefore this soul has no fear of its own mortality, has no ego, and is not devoted and obsessed with its survival or with self-preservation. It has a completely different agenda. It has a completely different perception of reality. And when we have these two souls, when we have the impulses and the tendencies of the natural soul, of the human soul, together with the impulses and the tendencies of the godly soul, now we have a choice, an option that we didn't think we had. We knew that we could do good or bad. We knew that we could be right or wrong. But now we know that we can be human or something more than human, something godly. We have within us an entire personality, an entire soul that is human and animal, and then we have a complete personality, a complete soul, which is divine and eternal. They obviously pull in opposite directions. Not because the human soul wants to be bad, but because the human soul wants to be human. And the godly soul doesn't just want to be good. The godly soul wants to be godly. Now we have an interesting choice to make. Now we have a much greater range of freedom of choice. It's not just that we can choose to do right or wrong, good or bad. We can actually choose what kind of a creature, what kind of a being do we want to be. We can be human, motivated, controlled, and governed by human properties, by human characteristics. Or we can follow our godly soul and actually be godly, motivated, guided, governed by godly impulses. That makes the choice a much more noble one. We're no longer standing at the gutter trying to avoid the ugly and the vulgar and the profane in favor of the decent and the good and the proper. Now we're standing at the threshold between creator and creation, where we can either be a creation with all that entails, or we can be a piece of the creator, part of the creator, and all that implies. And that's why the struggle, the difference between the tzaddik and the beinoni, is not doing good or doing bad. The beinoni does good. The beinoni is not vulnerable to sin. And yet, he remains a human being. A human being being good. A human being at his best. A human being serving his creator, but it's a creation relating to its creator. Whereas the tzaddik is motivated by his godly soul, as he will explain later on, motivated by the divine soul, and therefore is not governed by human instincts, not governed by the properties of the creation, but rather shares the tastes, opinions, and desires of the creator. So that what the creator finds an abomination, the tzaddik finds an abomination. They have common tastes. Whereas the beinoni might find sin desirable. Not that he wants to do it, but he sees the pleasure in it. He can understand the pleasure of doing the sin, even though God considers that very same act abominable. So they're in very different worlds. The beinoni lives in the world of creation and tries to get closer to his creator.